Here's our agenda of what I'd like to talk to you about. First of all, my goal is to spend about 15 minutes on each of three sections. First, to welcome you to a new economic world. School will be in session, and to say, how is the world different today? In fact, the job of the economic historian is to remind people of what the world was like in 1810. All right, it's dramatically different. Second of all, we're going to look at ways of thinking about the world using modern economics, so Keynesian macroeconomic measurements. And what I'll say is how economists are making fundamental errors in the way that they're thinking about the world today, so that even a group from, where I would argue the Bible has more to say about human nature than modern economics. And so that's our third session for about 15 minutes, biblical categories to talk about vocation and ways I would suggest that the church can speak to this age. And so that will hopefully lead into the rest of the discussions we'll have today and tomorrow morning. So that's our plan, and we'll have time hopefully for 15 minutes for dialogue at the end. So we're not in Kansas anymore when you think about the economic environment of the church. So if I were to ask you this morning, how many people are there in the world? Does anybody know off the top of your head?
7 billion.
7 billion? Close enough, give or take 192,759,541 people, as according to the U.S. Census Bureau yesterday morning, are inhabiting the planet. And so it's valid, I think, to ask ourselves the question, how did we get there from, how do we get here? So here's a graph showing billions of people over here, and across here we have the beginning of time. Here's Adam and Eve expressed in billions. And so time of Abraham, David, time of Christ, the Crusades, and here's where the iPad was invented over here when there were 7 billion people. So economic historians would estimate that we had about 26 million people, about the population of California, spread around the globe about the time the pyramids were being built, just before the time of Abraham. Population took about 1,000 years to double to 50 million people, quite a considerable leap. By the time of Christ, it was just under 300 million, and in contrast, there's 309 million people in the United States today, spread around the world. And so you see where this is heading. The Crusades, and then 1810 is the year that they estimate we had 1 billion people alive at the same time on the planet. And so to put that into perspective, it took 4,000 or whatever you want to call it years to get the first billion, a little over a century for the second billion, 32 years, and I have a daughter who's 14, so a billion people have been added to the planet in her lifetime. The population of the world has doubled since I could drive an automobile, and it was a lot easier to park when I was younger than it is today, okay? And so the question I have for you is, how do you feel about this? Do you feel positive or do you feel negative when you look at this graph? The audience participation part of our talk.
Positive, they're fulfilling God's mandate to humanity.
So, positive? Is anybody positive?
Well, I mean, I used to, there are a lot of people who are terrified of this, and I used to be a little bit overwhelmed. And then I guess I was playing off of an article or an item in Harper's Index a long time ago, Harper's magazine, and they were talking about how you can put all the people together, and I did some math, and it turns out you can put all seven standing close together in the city of Houston. I mean, the footprint of 7 billion people is very small, and so I'm not terrified.
How big is their carbon footprint, though, Mark?
Manageable.
Isn't this interesting? And this is where we're going with this, is many people are terrified, as you say, of this. This is a very bad thing. From a biblical perspective, I think you can only argue this is great news. This is the creation mandate being fulfilled. Every one of these is a living soul. The opportunity for missions is huge. From an economist standpoint, however, this is great news. All these people need shoes and cars and houses. These are enormous markets and an enormous workforce and so forth. This is really good news, but most people think this is bad news. And so the church needs to be speaking into this situation. Okay, and it's not just because of the creation mandate, but just the data. This slide shows production of meat and cereal compared to population. And so this golden line here shows population. That exponential curve you saw has been flattened out to make it easier to see. And the message is from 1966 to today, the rate of production of cereal, grains, wheat, and corn has been increasing faster than population. And meat production even faster than that. So that it's been 9 years now that UN has reported that there's been enough food for everybody in the world. 2,500 calories a day for every man, woman, and child. Now, sin has not gone out of the world. So distribution problems and wars and other things mean that there are still hungry people. But never before in history could you say that there was enough food for everybody, even faster than the rate of growth. This is a more complex slide, but this is the commodity index of petroleum, oil, iron, steel, molybdenum, all these industrial type commodities that are used. This is from 1940 to today. And when the population of the world was 2 billion, prices were higher than they are today with 7 billion people. Now, what does that tell an economist? That means that these resources are being discovered, invented, and generated faster than the population is increasing. In other words, we're getting smarter faster than we are reproducing. This is incredible news, and once again, it's good news, but it runs counter to what most people think. And in fact, if you look at why the prices were high, you can see the Korean War and World War II. You can see the Arab oil shocks of the 80s. It's really a problem of sin that causes things to be disrupted, whereas the general trend is toward lower prices or greater abundance. Even food costs less than ever before in the history of the world. Now, some of you mentioned your wives and families, and I'm not sure my wife would agree with this slide, so I can see the skepticism on your face, and you know your own budget, but those are nominal food prices you're talking about there. That's more because the Federal Reserve is printing lots of dollars. The dollar is worth less, I'm not gonna argue that, okay, but food, I will argue, is less expensive today than ever before. So let's take as our example, this is a standard 3.5 pound frying chicken. Okay, you can measure it throughout the last 100 years, and if you measure the cost of that chicken in 1920, not in dollars, because my grandpa paid a nickel for a loaf of bread, but my grandpa only made $5 a day, and so that loaf of bread was expensive. So if you measure the chicken in the number of hours at the average wage it would take to purchase a chicken, it took a worker 2 hours out of an 8 or 10 hour workday to buy the chicken before you got the vegetables and anything else, the house and the clothes and so forth. So this is why in 1928 it was a meaningful slogan for the president-elect Hoover to say, a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, because that was a remarkable thing less than 100 years ago. If you go to 1970, here's our average worker in his factory. It only took him 12 minutes to purchase a 3.5 pound chicken. Much less expensive. And today, here's our worker over here on his walking desk treadmill, because he doesn't get enough work and exercise. 6 minutes to buy a chicken. So more than a 95% decrease in human life costs, right? Not the nominal price on the sticker, that's been going up, but the human cost has gone down dramatically. And also, let's just talk about the quality of the chicken. you know, the chicken is better today than it was, and no one even buys a whole chicken anyway. You just want it at Chick-fil-A, for example. Okay, so does that make sense? Food costs less, cars cost less, housing costs less than ever before in the history of mankind. So this is more complex, but trust me, it's worth it. This is a graph that shows the different nations of the world. Asia is in red. Here's India and South Asia. Africa is in blue. And North America, the Americas are in yellow over here. We're looking at health as measured by life expectancy at birth. So low 40s here for the Congo, mid low to low 80s over here. So people that are higher are healthier. And across the bottom is GDP per person. And that is, it's an economic surrogate for income of the average person. And so ranging on a logarithmic scale from 500 to 5,000 to 50,000. 5,000 in the middle, 50,000 over here. Down here, these countries are poor and sick. Up here, these countries are healthy and wealthy. And so you can see the incredible disparity that we have in the world. Or can you? So in fact, let's just roll back the clock here to to 1810. As I said, the job of every economic historian is to remind people of what the world looked like in 1810. And so you see that the average life expectancy of the wealthiest country, Great Britain and the Netherlands, was 40. And the average wage of the wealthiest country was just over $3,000. And so let's start the world and see how we got there. And so here we are by the Civil War in the United States. Here is the railroads. Here comes World War I. There's the Spanish epidemic. So you'll see the Great Famine of China. And here we are in the 80s. You'll see that it turns out that the poorest countries in the world are in fact healthier and wealthier than the best countries 200 years ago. And that the incredible inequity or disparities we see is not because wealthy countries have stolen from poor people. Everybody was poor. It's that wealth has been created for the first time in ways we've never seen before. Okay? And where I'm going in this first point is I'm trying to persuade you that it's worth your time to be thinking about vocation. It's worth your time to be considering economics and how the church works, because the church has never seen anything like this. All right. And here's 2010. Yeah, so now you can see that, yeah, it just amazes me. Nigeria today would have been the best country in when Jonathan Edwards was writing, for example. All right. This always rocks the house with economists, but I'm not sure it's worth the effort here. But so let me summarize this. One of the huge reasons for income disparity is that people don't live long enough to earn a wage throughout their whole life. And so, and it's hard to get demographic and data over time streams, but in Sweden and Italy, we have this. For the United States, this trend is true. Compared to 1751, compared to 2011, this is the percentage of people who, the blue, are still alive by this age. And the red, obviously, is mortality. So in Sweden, in 1751, 20% of the children died before their first year. Okay, another 10%, so 30% died before they were 5 years old. And most people, half the people were living then up into the 60s and so forth. So you see that this is the amount of sort of corporate life available. And here's the hard thing. This is an economic index called the Gini index that measures inequality. And so one is perfect inequality, zero is perfect equality. And so lifetime earnings was very unequal is the message here. This is what Mexico City looks like with respect to income today. Very wealthy, very poor, according to that index. Bottom line is now only 0.2% of children die in Sweden before their first birthday. Only 0.3% die before they're five. 90% of the people in Sweden live to be 60, and then the median age of death is 86. And the bottom line is income equality of all people born is much more equal. So the snapshot you just saw was for 1 year, not a lifetime. And so now, yeah, lifetime earnings are leveling out like never before. All right, so as a result, global poverty has fallen in half. So in 1990, 47% of the world's poverty was living on under, 40% of the world's population was living on under $1.25 per day. And now, as of 2010, that's 22%. The church needs to be aware of this. Okay, The Economist magazine, you know, the business magazine from England, basically is tracking this trend, and they're basically suggesting that by 2030 or so, under 3% of the world's population will be living at these super low levels of poverty. So 20 years from now, the church needs to be thinking about how we react to that, because when people are starving, it's easier, if you will, to know what to do. You send them bags of grain and rice, and you give them clothing. But what happens when everybody has enough to eat, is not in destitution, is wearing clothes that have been donated to Goodwill in the United States and shipped to Africa by the half-ton bale? How does the church serve them in that environment? So that's what the data suggests we need to be thinking about. Here's another, this is counting the poor by region. Okay, these were the people who were poor in 1990 on a percentage basis. In 20 years, you see China's poverty rate has fallen from 60% to 10%. Other South Asia, besides India, similarly. And so Africa is lagging somewhat behind. The United States is not even on here. They don't even list North American poverty of these scales. But here's my point leading into the next section. The truth is, and this is an economist speaking, we have little idea of what we're doing. And it's certainly a mistake to let anything important depend on such numbers. This wasn't done by central planning. This was done by entrepreneurship and other trading activities. So the economists can't quite explain exactly why this is happening. And that's why I'm glad you're here, because I think God's word speaks to this situation better than they realize. So here's my last slide in this section. This is the trend of income from 1000 BC as a standard, as 1810 is our standard, and to today. And so you can see that basically the average income of the average person was essentially unchanged until 200 years ago. And so let's just put a biblical overlay here. So the Apostle Paul was writing at this time frame, roughly, and here's a breakdown of what the people looked like. So 29% of the people in the first century in the Greco-Roman world were living in unstable subsistence. So one out of three. That unstable subsistence means if it's a good year, we eat. If it's a bad year for the climate or the crops, we don't eat, okay? We kind of make do and hope for another year. 27%, this is Bruce Longenecker's data, by the way, 27% were living below subsistence. These are your widows, your lepers, your prisoners. I mean, there's a big percentage of the population that was not surviving any given year. 26% would be stable subsistence. I'm a farmer with enough of a store that even if I have one bad year, I can eat to the next harvest. 15% soldiers, merchants, moderate surplus and inventory, and then the imperial elites, Bruce Longenecker estimates, were 3%. In other words, every Hollywood Cecil B. DeMille movie you've ever seen, where you envision Rome, those were the people that were in the film, not the other 97% who the Apostle Paul was writing to in Corinth and who made up the church. That's what I'm saying, is that the church, by the time of Thomas Aquinas and his writings, hadn't changed very much. By the time of Luther and Calvin, it still hadn't changed very much. Richard Baxter and the Puritans spoke to the economy, and gentlemen and lady, here we are. I would argue the church needs to think about how the external environment is changing so that we can apply God's word, his unchanging word, to that. That's the economic lesson for today. Here's a quick application of this. The creation mandate would be an example of how we can rethink and understand what the Bible has to say. You're familiar with God creating Adam and Eve, and he says to them, he has five imperatives. The imperatives are to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heaven and every living thing that moves on the earth. This is in the first chapter of your Bible. And God in his kindness both gave these commands and then gave very strong desires to obey these commands. This is right. So to be fruitful and multiply, we've just seen the graph. You know, we've seen people get married. You have children. You have strong desires that sin shatters and perverts, of course. But we're finally getting around to fruitful multiplication. It's pretty exciting to see in the last 12 years, a billion people filling the earth. Human beings are the only creatures to inhabit every climate zone on the planet. Other creatures live in the water, some live in the desert, some live in the mountains, some live in the rainforest. Human beings transcend all of that, and we expect that to continue, though all of them could fit in Houston, Texas, if they were so inclined to do so. All right, dominion over animals. Okay, there's many ways you can see that, but even in the smallest child, you have some desire to care for, and interestingly enough, I found, give Christmas presents to dogs and cats and animals. And so we have these strong desires corresponding to the creation mandate. The question I have for you is, what's the desire for this? Okay, subdue, kabosh, to make, pay tribute, to make useful. Doesn't mean pollute the earth. Doesn't mean destroy the earth. It means subdue. So in the human heart, where do we find that desire? Well, I would suggest that it used to be a lot easier for the church to see how that happened. You subdued the earth by plowing it. 90% agrarian, you could walk around and tell how people were doing in subduing the earth, and if you didn't get around to doing that, you didn't live long enough to talk about it very long. Even today, you could argue that with a tractor, it's fundamentally the same. You see the earth is being subdued, but only 3% of the workforce in the United States is engaged in agriculture. So my question as a pastor is, how are the people in your congregation obeying this fundamental command to subdue the earth? And by the way, how do we help them do that? And how do we measure that? It's not the same as it used to be. I mentioned that I was a plant controller at Ford, and I would argue that in a Ford plant, the creation is being subdued. Iron ore is brought from deep in the ground to make steel. Petroleum is brought out to make plastics. Silica sand for glass. And a pickup truck is an example of subduing the creation. But the question is, how do we know that? How do we know that? Well, you look at the accounting statement. If people will pay you for a pickup truck, it's their way of saying that is useful. Okay? In other words, I could go buy iron ore, you could go buy petroleum, you could go get the parts, but people paying $35,000 for a pickup truck are saying that is useful compared to the way creation was before it was transformed. Okay? People said, we don't want any more Pontiacs. okay? We would rather have iron ore and the silica sand. Just leave it where it is. Don't make Pontiacs. We won't pay you for them, okay? They're not useful to us. Or buggy whips or black and white TVs. And so, in other words, I would argue that the accounting measurement of the revenue of a company is a measurement of how useful creation has been made in a market transaction. Obviously, the cost of goods sold, the material cost, is how much of creation you've used. The wage cost is how much of the labor, the precious human life, has been taken in the transformation. And so, really, how much of creation has been used is captured in the cost of goods sold. And what's left over is an honest profit. So here's the controversial statement. My argument is that the presence of an honest profit is the new way that the church can measure obedience to the creation mandate in ways that we didn't have to before. And of course, let me speak to your concerns. Sin has shattered this, right? So there's greed, and there's fraud, and there's deceit, and there's all sorts of problems. But fundamentally, if an entrepreneur in the church is earning an honest profit, I think that is that satisfaction that they feel at the end of the year is really that last desire that we're looking for. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. So, our last desire. I'm tempted to take questions right now. So are there any questions before we go marching onward? Speechless or stupefied.
Yes, just Mark. A quick observation, just something I'm puzzling over. Going back to the wealth and life expectancy thing you were pointing out. When you see a list of the poorest countries on earth, overwhelmingly they're Muslim. And yet their Congo is in there, or Burundi, but mainly the Congo. And it's like, what's that about? Because I think it's a majority Christian nation. And typically Christian nations are doing much better. And I mean, it's kind of a Max Weber moment, you know, like the Protestant ethic and the spirit, because it's overwhelmingly Catholic, the Christian focus in Congo. But still, there are a lot of prosperous Catholic countries, and so I'm just trying to think, the impact of Christianity on a country is typically reflected in its economy.
Yeah.
What's with Congo?
And all right. So let me back up and get that framework as well. Yeah, the data, it's just incontrovertible that this is in Christian nations and where Christian ideas have impacted it, whether they're believers or not, and in Muslim countries, it is exactly not happening.
No.
So
it's a reverse minus touch.
14 I mean, miles
touch turns to squalor. I mean,
from my plant on the southern edge of Spain, you know, it was 2,000 years across. Donkeys were carrying sticks, hit by old ladies, and we had a state-of-the-art plant on the coast. Burundi and the Congo, the problem is they don't have any major rivers there. It's a transportation problem and a corruption problem.
Yeah.
And so if they had a Nile or a Mississippi, they don't. And so they can't get there. And beyond that, the government and what Belgium has done has sent them back. But even Africa has just crossed $1 trillion in GDP just 2 years ago. And so, you don't have to start out. It's easier to copy than it is to innovate. And so they're not laying copper cables for telephone there. They're going straight to cell towers. And that's a lot cheaper. So I have hope for Burundi even. So good question. Yes, sir?
On your last controversial conclusion, how do you account for the enormous profits of the pornography industry? I mean, would you say that's an example of a dishonest profit?
Yeah, it obviously sin is a profitable. And so, so in our churches, the first thing you have to do is draw the fence around moral occupations. And within that fence of moral activity, I would argue if you are not earning much of a profit, it may be because you're not making the creation very useful to people. Or if you are earning a bigger profit, then that's good. And by the way, there's a separate discussion in my dissertation on what do you do once you have that honest profit and how you're accountable for that. But I think it's really helpful to separate the income statement from the balance sheet.
So you'd say there's more to the definition of an honest profit than whether there's fraud or coercion?
Absolutely.
Or corruption.
Absolutely. I mean, just getting money, I was looking at Lisa's purse earlier, I probably could get out the door with that and she would never catch me. But that's not what we're trying to get here. An honest profit is a signal that you've served somebody.
Clearly you're signaling that by putting honest, because I've never seen an income statement that has the word honest in it. It's just revenue, cost of goods, profit.
Yeah. But partly my point is that we have been so focused on the sinful aspects of how people get money that we're afraid to talk about what is it signaling at its core. And I think we can separate those things out. And in fact, the church has to separate those out. So, yes, sir.
Thanks very much for this. I think it's great.
Oh, there's even more. I haven't got to the charts.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I think one of the most prescient people speaking on this right now is Deirdre McCloskey. Are you going to talk about her understanding of how all this grew out of Northwestern Europe in the Christian tradition and her attempt to recover virtue in economics and how it would address some of the kinds of questions that you're raising about honest wealth, virtuously gained wealth, and so on?
Part of what Ken wanted me to do is stir the pot. And I think Deirdre is going to categorically fail in that search for virtue in economics, and that only in the Bible are we going to find a solid foundation. So I mean, she's doing great work, and I appreciate as an economist what she's doing. But without a biblical foundation, it breaks down. And that's why I'm so eager for this seminary to be sponsoring this Commonweal project, because of its presuppositions of gospel centricity and inerrancy of Scripture.
Right. Her problem is she has to assume basic goodness in human nature, and that's where the difficulty is. I think she's right on the need for these virtues to be reestablished, but I think she doesn't understand the locus for it.
Yeah.
Can I toss into
sure.
We do need to recover the study of economic history and its interaction with the moral and religious presuppositions of the culture within which economic activity. I'm going to be talking a little about that in my talk. So this kind of the air show thing you're looking at. Can I also toss in 2 cents on honest profit? Wherever I go, as I travel to the seminaries we're working with and work with local churches, what counts as an honest profit is a question that is constantly coming up. And I just have to put on the table, I don't think that the Evangelical Church in America has done the hard work of thinking about how do we articulate what counts as an honest profit? What are all the concerns that have to be on the table before we say that's an honest profit? And I think we need all hands on deck on that. I think it's a question we've not yet adequately wrestled with, and I think we need to get going on that.
Thank you for saying that, because this is on vocation, and my next slide is going to be on wages. And I think that we have focused more on how should you work in your job as an individual, wherever you are in the corporation. But a broader look needs to be on where do jobs come from? And how do corporations form? And so I have a book there to that. Yes, Hunter.
David, a lot of what you have done so far reminds me a little bit of John Kenneth Galbraith's book, The Affluent Society, in the sense that he kind of charts this, what he calls a mountainous rise, which it looks like on your chart, right? A mountainous rise in human well-being. The question I have is, are you going to discuss it all? I may be anticipating. Are you going to discuss what it is that triggered that mountainous rise?
In my 60 minutes, I won't have time. Well, or let me just take a shot at that. I mean, for example, Wesley, when he was preaching to coal miners, and they got saved, and they showed up on time and sober, and didn't swear at the mules anymore, they ended up creating wealth. In other words, they were more profitable, more productive than their cost of living, and that leftover, that creation of capital, is really the trigger. In a more macroeconomic sense, sanitation was one of the big drivers. It's not very romantic, but when children stopped dying, that 20% before age one in Sweden, that used to be 40% in the 1500s. And so even that change was part of the geometric. So the economic impact took off just after the Reformation, and definitely was linked together.
As I was watching the presentation, and by the way, the maneuvering and the manipulation of that was just incredible. The little bubble moving down.
That's Hans Rosling's data.
Wow.
He's a Swede.
I was jokingly texting with Mike over there and said, wow, watching this makes me think of a post-millennialist. That, wow, Edwards is right. This is all just getting better in the end. But it does, on a serious note, it raises the questions of eschatology. And for me, how the church understands how we proclaim a message of hope, not hope in necessarily economic and material goods, but it's important for us to consider moving forward, how do we frame a message in this context, and what does the future progression of human civilization look like if it's an unending chain of abundance?
The way we address that is we preach the gospel of Jesus Christ as the only solution to sin, which is the problem that can't be solved by economics. And so human flourishing after you're saved is enhanced by this, and in fact, human quality of life, common grace, is enhanced before you're saved. But that's exactly what, in fact, I'll go to my next section. My economist friends make the mistake of thinking they can solve the problem of sin. They can't. That's why we're here. So let me go to the categorical errors that they make in trying to deal with that. I have one last slide in this section here to talk about not just honest prophets, corporate, but of individuals. So as we have opportunity, Paul writes in Galatians 6, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those of the household of faith. And so this is another example of a text that is very familiar, but I want to look at in light of these exponential changes. And so Friedrich Hayek, the economist, talks about the knowledge problem, knowing who to serve, having the ability to serve, and having the desire or the will to serve. Three components that are part of that. And when I talk about serving at home, I can do that because I know my wife, and I have the will to serve my children because I love my children, and I know what shoes they need and food and so forth, so I have both the knowledge and the ability to do good to my family. Or even in the local church, in my small group Bible study, guy's out of work, I know I can help him with groceries, okay? Another guy's moving from one apartment to the other, I know how to do good to them. I have the knowledge, ability, and Paul says I should have the will to do so. But what about the Monday to Friday part of my life in the workplace? Okay, it's harder to know, again, rewind the church. If we're a small village, 90% agrarian, small, it's easy to know who needs help and who I can help and who I can do good and so forth. But now in the marketplace, my argument is that we have the price signal, the profit signal, and in the case of labor, the wage signal. Where you might say to someone, they say, what's my calling in life? Well, it needs to be moral, you know, and following your gifting and maybe your passions God's given to you. But another valid question is, who will pay you the most? The person who needs your skill set the most will pay you the most. It's, again, sin enters in there, and it's not the only, but it's something that we need to put on the table again, yeah, from the church to say that, yeah, your wage is not the goal. Your wage is a signal of who needs your services the best or the most. All right. Oh, I'm going to spend 6 minutes on Keynes here. And so you'll notice these are taken directly from the Bureau of Labor Statistics of your federal government. And I've used their slides exactly. This is from September 5th. This is last Friday's job report. And it shows that, and everything, just to make it faster, from 1990s, a 25-year trend line for every chart. And this is the civilian labor force in the United States. So from 126 million to just over 155 million workers in the United States. This is how they are viewing vocation. And by the way, 25% increase in a labor force over 25 years is phenomenal. That's an amazing increase in the gross domestic product of a whole nation, the well-being, because of all those people. And they're more productive today than they were because the iPhone hadn't even been invented here and Facebook didn't come in till here. Those are time wasters. But anyway, so here we have, you see the recessions, but you'll see that the labor force has tailed off even though our population has been increasing. And so when we talk about unemployment, Lord Minor Keynes is concerned about that on a human level, but also because this is gross domestic product that has not been able to be realized. It's a loss to everybody because of that. And this is a problem because for a politician, these are voters, right? So when you have 15 million voters out of work in 2011, that's a problem. Still almost 10 million. But as you saw in the last slide, these absolute numbers are not so helpful because the labor force was smaller over here than here. And that's why we have what we call the civilian unemployment rate, which used to be higher in the Great Recession and as of last Friday had dropped to 6.1%. Okay, and so a politician looking at this says we need to create more jobs. The solution is to create jobs. And I'm going to argue that that is a categorical error in thinking about human beings. You don't need to create jobs. Friedrich Hayek said the way to create jobs is to outlaw diesel fuel in agriculture. Yeah. You get plenty of jobs if you do that. Okay, that's not the point. And so now here's your economic lesson for the day. I'll do this. So the government says, well, we need to know this in even greater detail because what's reported in the news is really what economists call U3 unemployment. But down here we have U1 unemployment, and this U1 are the people who have been unemployed for 15 weeks or more, so 4 months. The ones who are on the verge of maybe not making it back into a modern workforce. Or they measure U2, which includes not only U1, but people who have been terminated or laid off in the last month, or whose seasonal work has ended. Here's U3 that you're used to, and the technical definition, that speaker bothers me, the technical definition of U3 is people who are over 16, who are not in the armed services, and who are not institutionalized, in other words, in prison or in a hospital, people who have been actively seeking work in the last 4 weeks and have not received even a day's pay in the last 7 days. Now, I would argue that is not a biblical definition, okay? Just because you're not 16 doesn't mean you should not be thinking about serving people. Just because you're, in prison, we'll talk about that separately. But even in this, if you are a bricklayer and you've worked on Monday and got paid, that counts as employed, even if you don't actually do anything for the rest of the week. U4 measures people who are discouraged, who have stopped looking for work in the last month, but were looking prior to that. U5 are marginally attached workers who have worked in the last year, but have not worked in the last year, but would be willing to work, though they're not searching for it. And then U6 is the real one that you should look at. This is underemployed people. So people who want to work full-time, who are working 28 hours a week, people who have PhDs, who are driving cabs, And so, but again, this misses the point because here is the participation rate in the labor force. So on a percentage basis, and so just to speak to this downward trend, the number of people who are working has been steadily declining as a percentage of our population. Forget unemployed people, because all you have to do is to not be unemployed is to say, I don't want to work. Okay, my dad is not unemployed, he's retired, so he's not even counted in those. But when you think of the people who are actually working, or this is called the employment to population ratio, is only around 59%. And this is why the church needs to speak to this, because this is either great news or terrible news, or we're not sure. Okay? On one hand, this is great news. Only 59% of the people in the country work, and nobody's starving in the streets. Never before in the history of mankind could you have so many people not being productive and still eating. So it's great news. On the other hand, it's terrible news because people, the church needs to teach about vocation such that people would feel, recognize they're called to work and to imitate God and actually to be productive in those ways. And in this middle ground, I'm not sure what to do with this. Yeah. It's a mixed bag of people who are not working for lots of different reasons. And only a local church can know any individual to say, sir, you are disabled, you know, you're a veteran. You don't work for these good reasons and we're grateful. Or, ma'am, you stay at home with your children, so you're not in this number, this is good. Or, son, you gotta put down the Nintendo and you gotta get out of your mom's basement and you gotta get out there. Only the local church can help sort through what to do with this number. But the precipitous decline is probably not good. So that's the end of, the church is the only thing that can help the government sort this out. And broad one-size-fits-all program is not gonna do it. So let me defend economists here for a minute. This is chart 17 of 34. I go through this so you don't have to. This shows unemployment by under high school diploma, high school graduates, college and so forth. So the data is helpful, even to the church, to say, yeah, if God is calling you to serve people, education leads to serving people more effectively in the workplace. Or unemployment rate for teenagers, adult men and adult women. This is the minimum wage, by the way. That's teenagers have a hard time being more productive than $7.75 an hour, and therefore they don't get hired. And so economic data helps us understand this. This is interesting that men had higher rates of unemployment than women for one of the first fundamental times. The church probably should look into that. Here it is by race and ethnicity, and the chart speaks for itself here from the Asian culture versus Hispanic and so forth. And so the data speaks in ways the church should be interested. And so this is my second major point at the end of this section, to say that economics is not the answer. Economists think they have the answer. Sin is really the fundamental problem here, and only the gospel solves that. However, I think theologians and pastors need to understand how these tools of economics provides lenses to see ethical problems, okay? It provides the means to access problems that are now more complex than the church has ever faced before. And so I'm going to recommend some podcasts at the end, that maybe you should listen to some of these podcasts, not to get a master's in economics, but to at least realize that the church needs to understand this in order to serve. All right, so my shortest section here. Any questions? I got 12 minutes, so I'm not going to take questions. Here are three biblical categories to get you started in your thinking about vocation. And I'm not going to go through all of my assumptions, but here's the world before 1810, life expectancy at birth, 26 years, war, famine, disease, violence, okay? In that, we're assuming you're gonna work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, sun up to sun down, on average, that's 82,000 working hours in your lifetime. By the time we get to circa 1900, United States, where we have good data, average life expectancy for adult white males was 68 years. War was still a problem, disease and accidents as well. If you enter like my grandfather after you get done with eighth grade and you work until the Social Security Administration, you know, 65, and then life expectancy was 68 then, 3 years. 60 hours a week is 162,000 working hours, or 41% of your waking life. Today, it's harder. Let's just assume you go into the workforce at 20, some more, some later. You retire at 62 with Social Security. You're most likely to die of obesity and smoking rather than war. And so if you're working, and this is the average, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics for last month, the average American works 35 hours a week. And so that's 75,000 hours working in your lifetime. Here's where the church needs to speak. Okay, that's only 16% of your waking hours to survive. Whereas this person was working all they could to survive, here, you're not even working. You don't even have to work that much to survive. So we're talking about the hours left over. Let's call those leisure. And so now we have about 7 times the leisure hours that the church was looking at before. And so I think we need to help people understand what vocation is and what work is. Because you don't have to work to survive. You need to work to give glory to God because you were created that way. You need to work to serve other people and so forth. Work needs a new reason. And if this is not true today, just give me 10 more years, okay? Just give me 20 more years. So for you who are the new generation pastors, this is. So how do we view a job? I would argue biblically, we don't talk about Keynesian creation of jobs or even going to somebody and say, give me a job, which I would submit is one of my critiques of Christians who've been writing in this area. I would humbly say, we usually just assume the job and then we look at the person. And the church needs to be thinking about where do jobs come from? Or even not even that, it's how do we help people talk about how do I serve people in love throughout my life? In my home, I know how to do that. In my church, I sort of know how to do that. But in the marketplace, that's really what I'm doing. And Mr. Truitt, who just died, his quotes in the Wall Street Journal just captured that. He saw himself at Chick-fil-A serving people. And so jobs are not the goal. They're the means to glorify God, to subdue creation, and to serve other people. And so I don't know if you've seen this new book, The Alliance, from the founders of LinkedIn, from Harvard Business Review Press. Basically, they're saying lifetime employment's over, okay? And so how do we form alliances with companies and groups of people to transform ourselves and to transform companies? It's a new way. The Harvard Business Press is looking at the workforce. My argument is the church should be thinking about that too. And I have a copy of the book over there as well. All right, and so what does this mean for you guys? I would just suggest here are 4 podcasts that you could put on your phone while you're working out to think about. So Planet Money over here is the easiest. It's 20 minutes long, twice a week. It's by NPR, very, very liberal, but it's hilarious. When they look at the real numbers, they end up sort of sounding like Fox News because the numbers are stubborn. Freakonomics, very interesting. The problem they have, I would argue, very helpful from an economic standpoint, but they think they can replace God. They explain too much. The Economist out of Britain has the best worldwide coverage. If some of you would listen to this 1 hour a week, you would be an expert in a year. Once a week, Russ Roberts here from George Mason University and the Hoover Institute at Stanford, he interviews PhD Nobel laureates on current events. And then he translates for the listener. So he asks the question, and they give an answer, and he says, so what you just said was this. That's the one I would recommend, Econ Talk, and their online library of transcripts is very, very helpful. I'm going to skip this slide about the creation of wealth that goes beyond vocation. So let's just get to the bottom line. So, number one, the church needs to reconsider how to meaningfully speak eternal biblical truth on vocation into this new economic age. That's my number one point. Number two, jobs are not the goal. Jobs are not a given. Jobs are a means so that people can, throughout their lives, think about who are they serving, in what ways, how are they transforming themselves, how are they transforming creation in the way they think about it. It's hard. It was easier when you were hungry and you just said, I'm going to plant because if I don't plant, I'll starve. Now I could work at Jiffy Lube if I wanted to. And I got to say, how does that fit into God's plan? Honest profits, high wages, and wealth creation are not the goal, but these are a signal that the goal is being accomplished in a fallen world. So helping the church rethink their view toward that. ExxonMobil made $43 billion last year. they made a lot of people happy in order to do that. There's also sin involved and more to it. But, and then finally, economics is not the answer. It's a tool to serve as the church teaches biblical truth. So with that, we have 6 minutes for questions. Yes, sir.
I'm trying to wait on this question, but maybe I'll get it out at the beginning. Just since we're trying to think through a biblical theology or a Christian worldview of work and vocation and economics, one thing that struck me as you were talking is when we think about work, do we always have to equate that with employment? Because when you look at all the various charts of unemployment and the rest, it seems like you can argue for what should Adam have been doing in the garden. It wasn't being employed, it was accomplishing certain things with a certain telos, a certain goal, the dominion mandate. I wonder if we need to think hard to keep from being confused about what is the proper distinction between work and employment. Because my wife has, a lot of the women in the community are drawn to her to talk and to receive counsel. And you could say she's serving the Lord, and that's a kind of work. She's fulfilling a certain duty and calling. Not employed.
Yeah.
Or at night, I could watch TV. I don't. I'm going back and working on a certain profession on biblical languages, mastering a discipline, helping for no money, run a local Christian school. That's all work, but it's not employment.
So, I'm so glad you asked that question to get that to begin with. So the Apostle Paul uses the word kapiao, toil, labor, to refer to what he's doing in the church and to what he does in the marketplace. And he refers to women working at the home in the same way. And so that's why I had the three spheres, home, church, and work. I'll take work as all of those things. And that's why I think it's more helpful to go back to the creation mandate. So you're saying your wife is sort of leaning toward the fruitful multiplication. Or even in education, you're part of that, because God's not just wanting breeding like rabbits. He wants worshipers who worship in spirit and truth. Or maybe, you know, you're more involved over time in dominion over animals, but many people deal with subduing. And it's partly easier than ever before. It's a great question. Yes, sir. Okay.
You know, there are also issues of how people rationally respond to conditions of prosperity. What I mean by that is, even in terms of our social welfare policies, I met a man at a party in Houston, probably like 2009, and you know, we asked, what do you do, as you almost always do when you meet somebody, and he was unemployed. He had been a software engineer or something like that. And I asked him if he was looking for a job, and he said, no, you know, my wife is a nurse, and I'm getting unemployment, and you know, I'm staying home with my daughter instead of her being at the daycare, and I just feel like we're better off this way.
See, never before in history was that true.
Now
the church needs to speak to that man and say, you've missed the point. Right. The signal is, you're of no use to anybody. You are not serving anyone.
Yeah.
And so, where's God calling you to serve? And that's to stir the pot. I'd say sometimes nonprofits are that way too. The reason they have no profits is because nobody's being served. And so, it's not always true. So...
Yeah, I like what you said there at the end. You think of vocation as calling. And I do think we've missed that. A lot of people in our pews think the only people who are called are the pastor and the associate staff, when in reality we're all called to serve God in different kinds of ways. And I think we need to restore for our own people what it means for vocation to be calling. Hopefully at some point along here we'll also talk about how we devalue certain kinds of work. Now, for example, I don't think college is for everybody. You know, liberal arts teaches you certain things for certain skill sets, but there's a whole other range of skill sets out there that a liberal arts degree is not what you need to do. There are carpenters and plumbers and steam fitters and all other kinds of people, and we have tended to devalue that as a form of work in society, and I think we need to rectify that as well.
I think going back to this language of subduing creation exactly means we love the people who fix the pumps and the pipes and so forth. I'm so, I was just, to my class 2 days ago, so grateful for indoor plumbing, right? All these kids, they don't understand how exciting that is. It's very exciting. And so breaking down the barriers between Sunday and Monday, between the home, the church, and the workplace, okay, how do we know how to serve in those ways? And this vocation, you're right. Yes, God.
I appreciate your saying that. I had one of my sons is taking what may be a very prolonged break from college. I've had to get over that. And he's pursuing some things for which it doesn't look like college is going to be necessary. But I agree. That's something we need to speak to. My question is, David, I know this wasn't the purpose of your presentation today. You obviously had more time to use it, but I want to, how do we make sure that in the discussion of economics and sort of getting it right, that we don't minimize the impact of sin on structures and numbers and figures and what those things, how we see the signals.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to approach this as just giving sort of a passing mention to sin. And I know you just didn't have time to develop that, so. But it seems to me in some of the more theologically conservative attempts to integrate theology and economics, we do tend to give short shrift to sin.
Right.
And so how do we make sure that we take sin as seriously as I think the Bible demands that it be taken and integrate that into our discussion of economics?
Let me do my best to address that now and then over lunch and in other occasions. There's obviously more. But the first step to that, I would say, is to recognize, because I think sometimes theologians are afraid of economics, like, wow, it's scary, and all these charts and all these things. It really is, economics is your servant. It is a tool for serving theology. It only describes and clarifies things. It never answers the question, why? Okay, it only describes. And so in that sense, yeah, it's theology, sin, is the problem. The gospel is the solution. The local church can't be left out of all this. It's just more complex. And the slides I have later in here, in case questions come up, we don't have time for it, is just dealing with the increasing complexity of the world. So I just think we just need to do the job we're doing as pastors and theologians, where sin is ever present as part of what we're thinking about. Economics just serves us as we do this to deal with complexity. Yeah, it doesn't supersede it at all.
Speaking of what Scott said, you have the extreme case of pornography, and that's not on this problem, but that's out of bounds. But one of the exciting things in academics today is the online course. You know, Liberty's sort of driven everybody to have a bunch of online stuff, and I think there's something of a paradigm in what we've had here today, like a sharp guy who knows his stuff, talking about things, and then people asking good questions, we're playing off each other's expressions and so forth, and there's a classroom thing, and yet there's a huge market for just staying in your pajamas and staying home and, you know, doing things in the Moodle and the like. And so instead of schools saying, well, that's tough, that's second rate, we're not going to do that, or maybe you take a few of those, we're like, everybody's running all over it. Now, I'm doing an online course right now, so I mean, I'm not pure, but is that an example of sin driving the market? Like, well, we'd rather everybody come here and sit around in a room and do this sort of collegial thing. But hey, let's get real. Are we pandering to sin?
Ken is going to tell me I'm out of time. So let me just commend to you. 2 weeks ago on the Econ Talk podcast, they interviewed Coursera, okay, the founder of Coursera. And by talking about the ins and outs, the pros and cons, the certifications in third world countries where they have, right, you know, 100 countries where there are students who are getting free education that they had no other access to, at least having heard that, the church can then have the dialogue. Does that make sense?
Well,
so Econ Talk breaks down the situation, and so that we can decide the ethics of it. They just describe it as it is. He's very libertarian, so he's just like, ain't it great because people get choices? Well, that's not good enough, but at least they break it down. So 1 hour podcast, listen to that, and give me a call. Call me in the morning.
Okay. First of all, thank you, David. Let's express gratitude.